Welcome. This is Christopher Holmes, and this is another two-hour radio show for Zero Point Radio through BBS. It is Saturday, December 11th, 2010. I'm coming to you just south of Ottawa, Ontario, and I work as a clinical and forensic psychologist through my life and as a consciousness researcher and writer on mystical and spiritual science. I have a website at www.zeropointspeltoutinletters.ca. I think the CA stands for Canada. I've into the fifth year of my radio show through BBS, and I usually have a co-host, Jim Moffat, and Jim's not available today, so I've got a two-hour spot here, and I'm going to open up the lines through the show today, and anyone is invited to call in and ask any questions or comment on things you've heard from previous shows or concerning the subject areas I'll go into today. So I'll give the number out is 888-815-9756. And feel free to call in at any time during the show. So it's thrown me off a little bit not to have Jim with me today, as over the last weeks we've been going through some of the Gurdjieff teaching and through the book I've published called Psychological Illusions on the Gurdjieff teaching. Yeah, Jim and I have been working at that, and we had planned on starting into talking about Gurdjieff's book, Beelzebub's Tales. So I thought today in planning the show, I thought what I would do, because I have at least four major current kind of focuses in my writing and what I'm working at. So I thought I would go cover each of those areas a little bit and talk about different types of subject matter. And the first project I'm involved in at the moment, I've just had a second article accepted by the Journal of Esoteric Studies. Or it's called the Esoteric Quarterly. And part one of this article series was called The Origins and Nature of Human Consciousness, The Heart Doctrine. And this was published in earlier in spring of this year. And, or actually, it may have been summer in the last issue. And the basic argument in part one of this article is that Western science and psychology has made a fundamental mistake over the last century or longer in firstly dismissing the possibility of human beings as having a spiritual or soul or divine nature, that a human being has some higher dimensional or metaphysical nature. We're not simply biological organisms and live and die with our bodies. So in modern science, scientists have assumed that consciousness is produced by the brain and that it's centered in the head. And this contrasts with different spiritual psychologies of the world's religions, which identify consciousness and the abode of God, in a sense, with the human heart. So in mystical teachings, the origins of consciousness are associated with the human heart and are not regarded as a product of the brain in the head. So in the mystical tradition, it's sometimes said that the truth is under our noses all the time. And it's like if you take where your nose is and you look under your nose, and just kind of under your nose is your heart. Well, mystics, when they say, know thyself, the idea is that most people don't know their true self. And instead, what we do is we take our personality and our conditioned, acquired nature to be ourself. and we don't really understand the mysteries of self. So in the mystical tradition, self-realization is described as the involving the dissolution of the mind, the false mind, into the lotus of the heart. So the idea is that the I experience in the human being emerges out of the heart. It's not produced somehow by the brain and mind in the head. Instead, it emerges out of the heart. And when I give lectures on the heart doctrine, I often get people to play a pointing game and get them to point to a wall and to the ceiling, or point to the left foot and the right ear, and then I ask people to point to themselves. And in a way, this is very interesting, because the vast majority of people point towards their heart area, and sometimes more between the heart and the head, almost towards the throat area. But people point more towards the heart than they point towards the head. And you'd imagine how silly it would look almost if someone, you asked them to point to themselves and they pointed their finger towards their head. It even looks strange. Even though some people who think about the question too much end up doing that. But really, most intuitively and naturally, a person indicates towards the center of the heart area or center of the chest area to indicate I or self. And indeed, mystics say that this is where the spiritual self is associated with the heart. And this teaching is in all different religious traditions. In the Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna says, "I am the self seated in the hearts of all living beings." So there the idea is that the super soul is within the heart, or God is within the heart. And then Swami Prabhupada explains that in yogic teachings, in the heart is said to be both the Paramatma, which is like the super soul or the Supreme Lord, and the Jiva Atma, which is the individualized spiritual soul. And Prabhupada says the Paramatma is infinite, but the Jiva Atma is infinitesimal. So we have the idea that it's like there's a spiritual spark associated with the heart, and that's called the Jiva Atma. In the teachings of yoga, that Jiva Atma is described as residing in what is called the bliss sheath, described as the size of a small grape towards the center of the heart. And the bliss sheath is described as a mass of unemergent light, that light that is contained within the volume of space, so that it's not light that's radiating away, it's light, it's unemergent light. And it is said if a person's consciousness resides in the bliss sheath, then your whole body, you experience being filled with inner blissfulness, inner kind of ecstasy of the soul. In its own inherent nature, the spiritual soul is, in yoga, is said to be Sat Chit Ananda, beingness, bliss. Ananda is bliss. So in its own inherent nature, the Jiva Atma is this bliss, is a state of blissful existence. And it's embodied in the bliss sheath. And we find this type of teaching, although it's described in different ways in different literature, like the Dalai Lama in Tibetan Buddhism, he calls it the permanent drop. And he describes it also as quite small, the size of a small grape or pea, in the area of the heart. And he says when life comes into a human being, the life energies emerge from the heart and they spread out through the body through three channels to a system of seven chakras. And that's all in the subtle anatomy. And that's analogous as to how white light divided by a prism gives you a spectrum of seven colors. So similarly, there's a distribution of life and consciousness from the heart center. Life and consciousness aren't only in the heart, but they spread out from the heart. And I would say the consciousness in the body is actually connected to blood flow in the body. So consciousness can pervade the physical body, just as you can learn to feel yourself all through your body simultaneously, and you can feel the blood flow in yourself. So, see, modern science thinks that consciousness is a product of material neurological processes in the brain. And I'm saying, no, there's something far deeper, that there's this spiritual element within the heart, and it is the life principle within the material body. So the self within the heart, it's actually tied into the generation of the heartbeat through the SA node in the heart, the sinoarterial node, and the AN node, and the bundle of His. The heart has its own inherent neurological system, and it generates its own electromagnetic impulses. And scientists have never been able to explain how the heart is capable of doing this. Okay, and they describe it as being an inherent property of the SA node, that it has this tendency to polarize and discharge and then depolarize and then polarize. And so somehow the heart generates its own electrical impulse and life comes into the material body. And in mystical teachings, the person is said to be ensouled through the breath. So, see, the breath is very tied into the circulation of oxygen through the blood. So life in the body is distributed through the heartbeat and the circulation of blood and the oxygenation of the body. And from a mystical perspective, that is how a person is ensouled. Okay, and you are ensouled by this, in a way, this living entity within you, this jiva atma, or we might give it other terms in other teachings. So I would say that a human being, in a way, we exist upon four planes of being, and this is in Kabbalistic tradition, and it's a very valuable distinction. And the first dimensions, or tree of life, is in the divine world. And the divine world is separate from the spiritual world, and then the psychical world, and then the material world. So really, we exist within these four worlds, represented also by the four elements. In the divine world, the mystical idea is that a human being has a divine source emanation within them. Okay, a divine source emanation. And this is a mystery teaching we find in different traditions. Okay, in the Gnostic Christians believed there was a divine spark, and that's how they described it, a divine spark. Similarly, the Kabbalists talk about a divine spark, or a spark of holiness. And in Sufism, they talk about also a God spark, or a divine spark. Actually, it's Shirley MacLaine in her book, Going Within. She said, oh, the basic New Age belief is that we all have a God spark within us. And she was talking mainly in a metaphorical way. But I, as a scientist in my life, have taken this concept seriously. Could it be that we do indeed have such a divine spark, or a spark of holiness within us? So that would be in the divine world. And the divine world, when creation happens out of nothingness, the divine world is not created. It is already inherent within the nothingness. So more what happens is it manifests its nature, or it stands forth. But the divine world isn't created. So first you have the divine world, and then we have the spiritual world, and that's the heaven worlds. And there, And so I would say similarly, there is a spiritual self. First, you have a divine source emanation, and I would say that that's brought down and it manifests as a spiritual self within the spiritual world. And that's also connected to the spiritual level of the heart. And then below that, you have the world of, in Kabbalah, it's called the world of formation, which I would say is your astral planes and your subtle planes that underlie the physical plane. That's the world of formation. And then the fourth world is the world made, and that's the actual material object or human being, the physical body. So I would say that a human being, or the human heart actually, ultimately there is a divine source emanation. And then there is a level of the spiritual self. And that is the level in life we want to attain to the awakening and realization of that spiritual self, or the spiritual nature. Below that is the psychic, the world of the psyche, the astral worlds, the worlds of desires and emotions. That's the world of formation, and then the world made is the material world. So in a way, each of these are a level of the human heart. So I would say you have a physical heart, but then you have a psychical heart, a spiritual heart, and ultimately a divine source emanation. So really, the human heart, I would say, is this multidimensional entity which isn't destroyed. Even if your physical body were to be destroyed, it would still exist within the subtle matters which give rise and inform the physical heart. Now, it's very interesting when you look at the research on heart transplants, and they do find that when people acquire other people's hearts, that they often have all kinds of psychical experiences related to the donor. And I remember particularly a book by Claire Sylvia, I can't remember the lady's name, but the book was called A Change of Heart. And she was the first person to receive a heart-lung transplant in Boston in the States. And after she was called up before a press conference, and someone asked her, what are you going to do as soon as you get out of the hospital? And she said something to the effect that she was going to have a beer and chicken McNuggets. And she kind of couldn't believe what she had just said, because she didn't like to drink beer and she wasn't so inclined to chicken McNuggets. And then over the weeks and months after that, she had experiences in her dream state of having feeling present to the donor of her heart, and she was able to figure out who the person was, because she realized he had died in a motorcycle accident. She was able to meet his family. She went and she met his family, and when she met his father, she felt what the donor's feelings had been towards his father. And she felt the donor's feelings towards his mother and her sister. So it was like she was in their household, and she had all his kind of feelings and emotions towards the different family members. And she said that the family had felt the same way. They had said to her, oh, it was like having our son home. So I would say that indeed this is true, that when she acquires a physical heart, the psychical heart is still very much tied into that, and its energies are embodied in the memory in the physical heart. So I think this type of experiences, and there are many of them around heart transplants, I think it indicates the psychical nature of the heart, that there are these feeling and emotional and desire states connected to the heart. Okay, now, in a way, if your physical heart were to be removed, I would say your spiritual heart center is there, like it's not dependent on the material, the material heart depends on the spiritual in order to function, but the spiritual can exist independently of the material. So even when you die and your heart stops, I would maintain that you still have a heart center, even though it's withdrawn into it. Well, I mean, it's always been in more subtle dimensions, which interpenetrate and sustain the physical. So in my understanding, I argue that the origins of the I experience in the human being really have to do with the heart. And that is where there is, in a sense, a singular I. Like in the Vedas, when they say Jiva Atma in the heart, they're saying there's a singular I. They're saying there's this little God spark, you know, or there's this little bliss sheath in the heart. There's this essential self connected to the heart. And we find that teaching of the heart doctrine, it's in Kabbalistic teachings, it's in Christianity, it's in Sufism and the teachings of Islam, it's in Tibetan Buddhism, it's in Hinduism. I know Buddhism less, but of course in Buddhism the whole emphasis is on compassion and the heart of Buddha. And also, see, in the mystical tradition, it's not only once, if you were to realize self within the heart and then experience this kind of inner blissfulness, and the other thing we experience is inward illumination. Okay, it's like being enlightened. It's like this inner world of light, and we can have more or less of that light. Most people, in a way, live in outer darkness. It's like they have no inner light. They have very little of this consciousness. So we have to acquire more consciousness. We have to become more consciousness. And there are different ways that we can work on ourselves to strive towards living in the light. And in the mystical traditions, the self within the heart is described as inherently self-illuminating, like the sun. Okay, and in the outer world, you see the sun is inherently self-illuminating. Okay, by some kind of ultra-chemical magic, it kind of transforms matter into radiant energy, and it produces its own light. And that brings light and life into the solar system. Well, the idea is that the self within the heart is similar to the sun in the larger cosmos. So the self in the heart is the light giver. And that light of the self is the illumination we can experience in terms of consciousness. Now, to understand consciousness, I think it's most useful to think of it as light, which illuminates things, allowing us to be aware of all different things. You see, just like I can have light in my room here, and that light allows me to be aware of the telephone and my article and my pen and my computer and the floor, and I can be aware of all these different things because there's a light source. Well, I'm saying similarly, in the human being, you can be aware of your thoughts or feelings or the pain in your foot or you have to go to the bathroom or it's too hot or too cold. You can be aware of all these different kinds of things because there is something which illuminates them, which allows awareness of all these different things. So the important idea, concept, is that there's a difference in a way between the consciousness as light and the things of which you can be conscious, or what form on the object side. In a way, there's the I and the me. And the I is like this pure consciousness or light, and then the me is all the different things you can be aware of. You can be aware of your pains and sensations, and aware of your thoughts, aware of your emotions. And these things are always changing. Your thoughts and emotions and sensations, all the time, they're constantly changing. But there's that constant consciousness there that allows awareness of these things. And the other very useful understanding to have of consciousness is that consciousness in ways is like space. And if you look around you, if I look around me in my room at the moment, I can see all the different objects in the room, a table and Chesterfield and all of these things exist within space. But can I see the space itself? And if one asks and thinks in this way, well, space itself is a form of no thingness. Like, space doesn't have a color, it doesn't have a smell, you can't touch it, you can't taste it. So space, it's like this thing which is no thing. But it's only because of this space, this no thingness, that we can then be aware of all the different things. So it's like you need the no thingness to allow things to reveal their existence. And in mystical teachings, see, one way we try to understand consciousness, it's like light. But another way, it's like space. And actually, the best symbol for consciousness that I know, or that I try to use, is the image of a point within a circle. Very basic symbol of the, I would say, of a zero point. Now, in Aleister Crowley's book, Aleister Crowley says the first principle of magic is that every man and woman is a star. And he explains it in terms of the conjunction of what he calls Hadit and Nui. Now, Hadit, spelled H-A-D-I-T, he says, is the star nucleus. It is the point of supernal light. It is the monad. It is the God spark. So the point represents the self. And the space, for Crowley, called it nuit, which is a French word meaning night. And so we can imagine the blackness of the night sky. And you have all these stars in space. And that's the basic concept of Hadit within Nui, that a human being's mystical nature, it somehow involves a point source of supernal light that exists within higher dimensional space, or Nui. Because when I say space, we can think of space as ordinary four-dimensional space-time, but then we might think also of there being hyperspace, like apparent space. Higher dimensional space that gives rise to the lower dimensional world. So for Aleister Crowley, he says human consciousness has to be understood in terms of Hadit and Nui. And Nui is like empty space. See, it's like consciousness is like having light within empty space. And it's because and each of us has this kind of inner being, this light and this space and this light, and because of that, and that permeates the body, then we can have all these different experiences. So how to understand human consciousness, I think, in terms of understanding in terms of light and space and how these things are related to the heart. Because I think our experience of consciousness and self originates out of the heart. And it's interesting, from my perspective, that there are some simple demonstrations of how consciousness is connected to blood flow. Like if I put my attention into, say, my right hand at the moment, as I do that and become conscious inwardly in my right hand, what happens is it warms up my right hand. I actually feel it getting warmer. And if I compare my hands before and after, I find if I put my attention into one hand and then I put my hands together, the hand that I put my attention into will have gotten bigger. Because when I put my attention there, it directs the blood flow to my hand, and so it enlargens my hand. Similarly, I would say that consciousness in the human being can be all through your body. It's not just up in your head. the idea that consciousness is only up in the head, I would say, has been the main delusion of modern psychology and science for the past century. They think all your inner awareness of being is somehow all up in your head. And they, in modern times, don't even think that there's a psychology of the heart. Even in modern science, they think the center of emotions is up in your limbic system and related to the fornix body and the amygdala and these structures in the midbrain. Can you watch a movie like What the Bleep Do We Know? And they kind of suggest that it's these parts of the midbrain and limbic system that are responsible for emotions. Okay, but how many people go home and tell your partner you love them with all your head? Okay, we don't go around and tell, you know, would you call your partner your sweet head? It would sound absurd. I mean, on Valentine's Day, if you gave your girlfriend or boyfriend a picture of a head on the piece of paper and said, I love you with all my head, I think everyone would have to think about it. Like, it sounds ridiculous. Why does it sound ridiculous? Because it's completely absurd. Love is a phenomena of the human heart. It's not something, a phenomena of the midbrain structures in the head. We can experience directly within the heart. The heart is an organ of feeling and sentience. It's the center of our being. We experience there. It's only the mind in the head that becomes so detached from that consciousness of the heart that the mind in the head comes to think it's like king, and that the mind and the intellect is like the master of the house. But that's not so. It's just false ego, in a sense. When a child is born, they're still centered in their bliss sheath. And that is why with very young infants, sometimes you look at them and it's like they're filled with gleefulness. And they take glee or delight in things. Okay, and I would say that a child who grows up in a supportive and secure and loving environment, they can retain that inner blissful feeling of the heart. And ideally that would be retained by people through their lives, and it would grow and enrich them as they matured through their lives. Unfortunately, what happens is the effects of conditioning and society and the media and the culture around serve to start conditioning a person. And he acquires all these beliefs and ideas and theories and viewpoints and opinions and so on and so forth, which he acquires from outside of himself. And most of these things that are acquired, see, they're not inherent to his essence. It's like it accumulates in the intellectual center, in the mind. And over time, a person can grow more and more in the mind, and the mind comes to usurp the heart as the center of a person's being experience. Okay, thank you. And that is what happens in a way, how a person's essential consciousness then, in a way, passes into the subconscious. And this false ego system, based more in the mind, becomes dominant. Okay, I've just heard from Seth here at BBS that I had invited a guest on, and I understand she's in the background here. And it was early this year. I was needing to publish my book on Blavatsky, and I needed help with the illustrations, and I happened to make contact with Zeljka Zupanic from Croatia, and we've kind of corresponded since, and Zeljka helped set up both of my Gurdjieff books and helped me get those published over the last 3 to 4 months. We've completed that task. And she's with us today. Zeljka, welcome.
Hello?
I didn't know if you were going to be able to make it or not. I hadn't heard back from you, so...
Yeah, I know. I sent you an email just an hour ago. Sorry.
Okay, that's fine.
Okay.
Well, I don't have Jim with me today. I don't know if you heard that.
Yeah, I heard that you said earlier. Yeah, that's not nice here.
Yeah, like, yeah, I could. I'm a big talker. I could talk for hours, even by myself. Well, thanks for joining. And I invited Zelska. Actually, I opened a little bit talking about an article I was doing, Zelska, and I hadn't really come to the Gurdjieff teaching. I was just kind of coming to that now. So maybe I'll get you to hold on just a moment, and I'll just kind of lead it up into what you and I might have shared about, okay?
Okay,
so what I've been talking about, the idea of the heart doctrine and how a person's essential consciousness is connected to the heart, and that in a way we want to awaken this consciousness. And Gurdjieff explains how our true consciousness, he says, passes into the subconscious. And instead, there's the formation of what he calls a false consciousness system, largely around based on conditioning and influences from outside of ourselves. Okay, in a way, what is not our own, whereas our essence is what we are in the structures of our being. And this leads into the Gurdjieff work, which we've been talking about. Jim and I were talking about last week. We ended up talking about Uspensky's definitions of psychology, according to the Gurdjieff teaching. And we had been talking about the process of self-remembering. And this is the essential practice within the Gurdjieff teaching. And the idea is that as we go about our lives, we make an effort, whenever we can remember to do it, to wake up, to be more fully conscious and present in the moment, wherever we are and whatever going on within us. So we start trying to lead our lives having these moments of remembering ourselves through our days and different weeks and over years. And the idea is that this is a way we start to study consciousness in ourselves, with the idea that we need to become more conscious or wake up. So, Zelska, in our correspondence, you had said that you were finding the material was helping you to get back to self-remembering.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wrote you that on email, but lately I realized some other things. So, but I wanted to say that I realized that I can't remember, that's for sure. And it's really hard. I even can't remember to remember it. You know what I mean?
Exactly, Zelska, and there's actually a story about someone who kind of dies and passes over, and he's kind of before the Lord, and he's asked if he remembered himself. And the whole point of the story is if he remembered himself, he would realize he couldn't remember himself. So he was supposed to answer no, that most of the time we live in forgetfulness. Like, we just become absorbed by everything happening in our life. You know, the work you have to do and the things happening at home and on TV. And we always become absorbed by everything and, in a way, lost to ourselves. And so, in a way, what Gurdjieff himself emphasizes, the first thing you learn with self-remembering is, in a way, how you can't remember to do it. And then we try to see why we can't remember to do it.
Yeah, that's what I wonder. If we are able to do it, you know, I wonder if we can do it at all, you know. But when I told you on email that like I remember when I was young. Actually, I remember that I was in state when everything was clearing. So I was asking myself, what was that? Why I can remember I feel like it's not the same. Now I have like more knowledge, and I realize it's maybe it's all this what I try to remember comes from my thinking, you know?
Sorry, Zelchka. I can barely hear you, and I'm getting some interference. And can you speak more directly into the phone? If you're not, it may just be because of the long distance.
Okay, can you hear me now?
That's better. Yeah.
Okay, that's better. Okay, what was the last thing?
You were saying how you remembered you could do it more when you were younger, or the feeling of it when you were younger. And that ties into what I was saying earlier in the show today, how when we're young, I think our consciousness resides more naturally in our heart, in our bliss sheet. And it's only as we get older that, in a way, we lose that.
Yeah, I know what you mean. But, you know, when I come to all this, so many things arise and I start to question again what is consciousness. I know you said now it's a light, but I think it's like a clear mind now when I think it like this, you know, when everything is clear, when you don't have thoughts, so you don't have to think about what is right, what is here, what is there, you don't compare, you don't, you know, it seems to me that my like this consciousness or light or everything is clear when I don't do things like this, when I don't think. So
yes,
actually all these things in one way I think I understand, and then I think other things it comes again and I think I don't understand anymore, you know, all this and all these words. I really like what Gurdjieff said, that we use words and actually don't understand that everyone, for me, consciousness means one thing for you, another, you know, even we think now, we can agree now, we can say it's this, and we can talk now, and we will understand ourselves now, but when we go in life with other people, and maybe if we meet again, day after, we will forget. That's what I realize. It's so hard to talk about all this.
Okay, I'll respond to a couple things you said. I like your description of consciousness as, I think you said, clear mind. Like, and you related it to how I was talking about light. And it's interesting, the Dalai Lama in Tibetan Buddhism, it is called the mind of clear light. And that's exactly kind of what it is. Like the light is like this mind of clear light. Like the light of consciousness is this mind of clear light. And it's like, as you say, it's like we need to stop the thinking. Like normally we have so much going on in us all the time, the different thoughts and feelings and sensations and our minds are always turning, and what we want to do is abide in that mind of clear light, and in a way from that position be aware of all that goes through us, and it's very subtle and complex, as you say, Zeltika, and words, you can't put these things into words. We have to, the words help us, but we have then to have our own experiences, and we're trying to develop a language to understand these things. Mm-hmm. That's what partly, like, we're trying to do through the Gurdjieff work, like trying to develop a language of how to understand what is consciousness and the way I distinguish it from thinking and feeling and sensation. You know, that's trying to develop a way of understanding what it is. Or I compare it to light, and that's useful and helps. And sometimes in states of heightened consciousness, you will feel illuminated, Like there can be this floodlight of inner light. We can have experiences of that. So all of these things, it's a subtle and complex task.
Yeah, but you know what? This is my opinion, okay? But what I realized, actually, I was asking myself why so many years, you know, there is so many religions, there is so many people who actually knew or they know, they said they know. You know, we quote all these things, all this, you know, all those people, and nothing actually changes, because I was asking myself why, you know, and actually the only man I gave me some answers was Krishnamurti. I don't know if you heard of him.
Yes.
Krishnamurti. Yeah. Yeah. And actually he was dealing with the mind itself. I really ask if it's all problem in the mind which divides, we make like soul. Actually, I don't understand what soul is, you know, but higher soul, you know, who can separate? Only mind which is divided, you know? And then we come to the point where all this we talk about, it's just, I'm asking myself, is it just, you know, another play of my mind, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Do you understand what I'm talking about?
Well, yeah, very, very good, and very good question. Mm-hmm. I found, like, Krishnamurti, he's very interesting. Like, I think he shows so much how everything is the mind. But in a way, what Krishnamurti doesn't have, in my view, is the heart doctrine. Like, he talks about, like, overcoming the conditioning and influence of the mind, but I don't think he has that concept at all of the awakening of the heart, which in my experience we can feel that directly. Like, it's not just thinking about it, but it can be a direct experience that people have. And Krishnamurti seemed to me very intellectually centered. Did you know at one point Krishnamurti was supposed to be like the new age star of the Theosophy Society? Did you know that?
Yeah,
yeah, and it was called the Order of the Star, I think it was. And they had a big meeting, I think, in the 1920s with people from around the world, and Krishnamurti was supposed to be crowned like the new leader of Theosophy, and he kind of rejected the role, and he said he kind of didn't, like, he rejected, like, the ancient, the wisdom teachings and such, and he said that the truth is a pathless land, like, that the religions and philosophies were just also much more dogma, and so he kind of rejected the role in Theosophy, and, yeah, very interesting, Krishnamurti.
Yeah, that's what I think. I think there is no way which you can approach to the truth. That's really true, because it doesn't make sense. Life is like that, you know, nature is like that. So it is like that. There is no way, you know. Everything says it. So I don't know. It's obvious. It's obvious for me, okay? But.
Yeah. I do think there are many things that can help us approach closer to having experiences of awakening and insight and illumination. So I do think there are useful things. I certainly don't think one religion or one path has the only answer or solution. And many teachings and such are incomplete. But there are very valuable things, I think, still within the different traditions. Well, do you have a religious background, Zelchka?
No.
No?
No.
Yeah.
Actually, here in Croatia, we are like Christians, you know?
Yeah.
But I didn't go to church, and my family is not, it was an oriented, you know,
yeah,
that way. But yes. I heard in school, and you know, I was taught about it, but I, you know, so actually yeah, I've been dealing about all this when I got. It was like life put me this way, because I got ill like 3 years ago after I gave birth to my child. I got really ill, and actually after that it was the way when I realized I need to take everything in my hand, otherwise I will be dead. So that's when I started actually live. That's what I would call live.
Actually sleep? Did
leave.
You say? Sorry?
I said I started to live. Leave like leaving.
Dissociating?
Before that, no, like I think before that I was like a robot. Okay, I'm robot still, you know. But do you understand?
I'm not sure. You felt like before that you were like a robot?
Yeah.
And not just a machine, like a robot. Yeah. I function automatically.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Exactly. And I became ill because of that.
Yeah.
So I was like, I was perfect human being for pharmaceutical, you know, industry to take drugs to the end of my life, but when I realized that that's not the way I want to live, so
yeah,
that's why I say I started to live after that, because then I started to look at myself to see what I'm doing, and you know, all that stuff. It was horrible, of course, when you start to look at it.
Yeah, Gurdjieff says on one occasion, he says, anyone who is not horrified at themselves has not, like, studied themselves, has not observed themselves. And in a way, it's like when you begin to wake up, you kind of are horrified by yourself. You begin to see how asleep we are, or how self-centered, or how... All these things, when, like in the Gurdjieff teaching, you start seeing this in yourself, and in a way, it does cause one to be horrified by oneself, but in doing that, it helps us to wake up and be less caught up and absorbed by those aspects in ourselves.
Yeah, that's so true. Yeah. Mm.
I found in life that knowing how to self-remember, in a way, made life more of an adventure. Because it was like, if I was going out somewhere, if I remembered to self-remember, and then when I would go to a shop, a shopping mall, it would be like I would curl my tongue back in my mouth, which is what yogis do, because it helps to still the mind. Because when you think... You kind of talk in your mouth, but if you curl your tongue back, I do that, and you put it up towards the top of your mouth. And after a while, you get the taste of what they call nectar, because you're closing a... So I do that sometimes, and I'll walk around in the mall, and I'll just be trying to be aware the whole time in my breathing. See, when you self-remember, you really want to connect to your breathing, because your soul life is connected to your breath. And the more you hold your breath, your aura contracts. And then when you relax and breathe properly, it expands your energy field and it vitalizes you. So I would think in self-remembering, it's very useful to work with the breathing.
Mm.
Has that been part?
I will try that with breathing.
yeah, I think that's really valuable. They say in Buddhism, a monk will actually try to go through a day being aware in every breath. I can't personally do it for 5 minutes, but when one does it, it's like everything slows down, and it's like you're so aware in the moment, and it's like you're aware of this is how I experience. I'm aware of everything around me. If I maintain my awareness in my breath, it's a interesting experience. So, anyway, I'm pleased to hear that you're continuing to work at self-remembering. And have you been reading some of Psychological Illusions?
Yeah, I've come to third chapter. I've been really busy last month. So
I understand.
But I've come to third chapter, which is good. I've read some things I've never heard before. Actually, I told you my friend read all book in few days. She was amazed. Yeah, she was amazed with all these things, and she really said that something changed in her. So I wanted to share this with you here.
Yeah, really. It's encouraging to hear that. And that's amazing. She actually read it right through in a couple of days, because it's a long and difficult book. Like, it's something you can reread different times in your life and you'll understand it more. And
I asked her, did you start to read? She said, you won't believe I'm done.
Wow.
And she told me all that, so it was nice.
It's such a new way of thinking, eh? It's like it talks about things that normally you'd never think about or even imagine. It's like a whole new way of understanding.
Actually, you can't hear it anywhere, you know? It's really different.
Well, I'm continuing. I've almost reread Beelzebub's Tales. And over the next couple of weeks, Jim and I are going to do some shows on Beelzebub's Tales.
And, I will listen to that. I'm really interested what Gurdjieff wrote.
it's such a unusual story, and I was so pleased with the version of The Slugs. Is this a book that I've written that Zelchka has produced, and The Slugs is about Gurdjieff's book, Beelzebub's Tales to His Grandson, which I'm going to talk a little bit about later. But we've come out with The Slugs about 2 months ago now, and I'm so pleased with the new version of it, because it really addresses all the terrible things going on in the world. And when I'd read Beelzebub's Tales before, I could never see the connection between things he said and the world scene. Whereas now, kind of waking up to all the terrible things going on in the world, it's like his teaching has a whole new significance to me. Hey, Zelchka, were you surprised by some of what he talks about, like the Hus and the Mus individuals and the Krats and the...
I didn't read about it yet, so I can't talk
about
it.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I guess when you're editing and setting it up, you don't get to read it all. Okay, well, thanks very much, Zelchka, and I hope we can get you back in a couple of shows into the new year, and we'll be talking about Beelzebub's Tales. And anything else you'd like to add or comment?
No. Nice to talk to you.
Okay, and I sent another copy of The Slugs off to you last week. I forgot to tell you I mailed that off.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, thanks. And thanks so much for your work and help to me this year, Zelchka. I so appreciated it. I had no expectation to have those two Gurdjieff books produced this year. It was really just wonderful for me. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Great, I'm happy. You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Okay. Goodbye. Okay, so that's Zelchka, and as you gathered, she's the one from Croatia who helped me get these books set up so nicely. And both books are produced so nicely with use of kind of black pages inside and setting up the quote from these in large script from these pages. They're very attractive books. I hope people, you can By the way, I should say, if you go to Amazon.com and you put in my name, Christopher P. Holmes, you'll see the four books I have printed are up there on available through Amazon. Okay, I don't know if I have Seth in the background there, but if I do, or someone at BBS, I think I might take a five-minute break. I didn't know if I had a piece of music or something we might play for a few minutes, and I'll keep going here, but if I'm heard, then I may take a break for a few minutes.
I remember all the stories my grandpa used to tell about a time in this sacred land. The buffalo did roam out on the open plain. The eagle soared high up in the sky. There wasn't any shame, there wasn't any pain. Yes, he said, they were so very proud. They lived a simple life, Mother Nature did provide. There was no law, but there was no crime. He brought his way of life. Nothing's been the same the day the white man came. Yes, they brought their whiskey and they brought their gun. They took away our land, they put us on the run. Locked us on this reservation, changed our ways of life. Promises were made, but they were only lies. The nations, they will rise. All the chiefs from long ago, they will be by your side. Into the battleground, a warrior you will ride. Armed with years of wisdom, many years of pride. The day the white man came, he brought his way alive. Nothing's been the same the day the white man came.
Welcome. That's Robin, a Canadian native man, a very beautiful song, Sacred Land. And I'd like to thank Zalchka for coming on as a guest. And thanks, BBS, for allowing me a break and some musical interlude there. It's unfortunately a bit hard for me to hear Zalchka on the phone, so it's... I'm not sure I was hearing interference. I hope people were able to hear a little bit better than I did for parts of what she had said. So to come back then, so I had been talking about the concept of the heart doctrine, and then we got into talking about aspects of the Gurdjieff work, which has been our focus for the last 2 to 3 months now. And I thought I'd use the next part of the show today to switch focus a little bit. And over the last 2 to 3 weeks, I've been doing an investigative report on a series of videos. And the video series is actually called September Clues. And September Clues is based upon the corporate media analysis on the day of 9/11, when supposedly radical Muslims hijacked airplanes and flew two into New York towers and one into the Pentagon and one which was blown up or something in Shanksville, West Virginia. The day of 9/11. And what September Clues is, it's a series in about 8 to 10 parts, and I think there are different epilogues, and there's some various forms of it. I think there's some slightly different forms. It's a remarkable documentary series doing a critical analysis not only of the media's coverage of the day of 9/11, but also of videos and materials that subsequently emerged after 9/11. And my focus initially in researching this video series, which is available through YouTube, you just put in September Clues and you'll come to the series. My initial focus was on this issue of, were there any airplanes on 9/11? Now, people generally accept that they don't think there was an airplane at the Pentagon, because the initial hole created in the side of the Pentagon was about 16 feet wide, and you couldn't possibly have had a passenger airliner go into the Pentagon, and there was no evidence externally of any major wings or tail sections or anything like that. So most people accept that there wasn't an airplane that hit the Pentagon. And most people accept that there wasn't a plane that landed in Shanksville, because if you've ever seen the picture, that this is shown in the September Clues series, the lady is holding a picture of like a mushroom cloud behind her, which looks like a symmetrical explosion behind her. And that was supposed to have been this airplane that crashed. And all they found in West Virginia was like about a 15-foot hole, about 10 feet wide, and that was it. And there seemed to be some garbage strewn about. But in West Virginia also, there was no evidence of airplanes. No wing sections, no engines, nothing. So I think it's more widely accepted that there weren't airplanes in Shanksville or at the Pentagon. But then the issue remains, were there any airplanes at all? And, of course, everybody is absolutely convinced that there were airplanes. And why are everybody convinced there were airplanes? Because you saw it on your own favorite TV. So one of the most unusual things about the airplane attacks on the two towers is that both times the airplanes are reported to have hit these two towers, the airplanes, fabled airplanes, very conveniently disappeared inside, completely out of view. Okay, when they hit the building, there was no wings broke off, you know, even though the wings were aluminum, light aluminum compared to the steel frame on the building. I mean, we could see why an engine traveling in a jet might pierce right through the outer shell of the building. But to think all the way the wings and the tail sections would just carve a hole straight into the building and the whole airplane would just disappear inside neat and tidy. And then when we see the whole of the buildings, there's no evidence there of a tail section or any part of an airplane sticking out of the hole or inside the hole. So really all we have of evidence of the airplanes is these brief images shown on corporate media on that day, and then subsequent videos that surfaced showing a few seconds of these airplanes, which are supposed to have entered into these towers so completely. Now, firstly, I absolutely do not believe that the airplanes could so easily pierce the towers and not break off upon impact. And if you actually watch pictures that show the plane entering the tower from kind of below the impact, in one frame of the picture, you actually see the left wing of the airplane has disappeared, but there's still no hole in the building. But the plane, the wing on that side is no longer there. And then if you advance the frame further, you see evidence of there being explosions surrounding the area of the right wing. And in this picture, the airplane just enters right into that tower. But in one still of the video, the plane actually loses its wing. Okay, really, see, what I've determined now from studying this video series, September Clues, over the last month, I've kind of been working at this. It's become a much longer project than I thought. I spent almost 40 hours, and I've only written up the first half of the video series, which is only an hour and a half long, all 10 sections of it. And as one looks more and more closely at the corporate media coverage of that day, there are so many peculiarities around the fabled airplane, around the witnesses, around so many elements in the corporate media coverage. And I'm going to go into some of these in a few minutes. The conclusion I came to through my investigative analysis of the September Clues series is that on the day of September 11th, the five major networks that covered the events live, in fact, were all pre-scripted. And they created the images of the planes in their own media studios. They used sound effects. They had scripted witnesses. The whole thing was a fraud. And the media were actually complicit in staging this fraud. So they weren't just telling you what was happening on that day. They all knew ahead of time. They had their roles to play. And they acted it out on that day. It was Hollywood, USA, brought real life to real life TV in New York City. And I consider now that the September Clues series actually gives criminal evidences towards the corporate media that they actually played an active role on the day of 9/11. And I believe there were no airplanes. There was no airplane that entered into the building. All you really had were people in labs, visual labs, making it using some type of computer programming or visual technicians who know how to use different layerings and videos. And they created and imposed these images of an airplane to create this mythology of these hijacked airplanes. And I would say that all that happened was that there were simply explosives planted in the building, and the initial discharges were blown out in the shape of an airplane to make a possible feasible story. But I think if you look at this September Clues, one finds so many peculiarities that the only possible way of explaining it is that all five networks were co-conspiring together to deceive the American public on that day of 9/11. Now, this September Clues series, the part A of it, or actually it begins with the five major network coverage of those moments when the second fabled airplane hits the South Tower. So this series begins with the clips from the five major broadcasters, CNN, NBC, MSNBC, Fox, and another station, five networks, and what they played and what was happening in the studio at the moment where the second fabled airplane appears on the screen and appears to crash into one of the towers. Now, if you take all the live coverage of this event, there is only approximately 15 seconds of coverage of this supposed airplane. Okay, most of the clips have the airplane in view under 2 seconds. Two of them are under 2 seconds. So it's just brief glimpses of these airplanes. Now, I'm going to go through some of the, we'll take first the CNN coverage on that day. And the CNN coverage, it's about a minute long, their clip in this movie, and the airplane is in sight for approximately 2 seconds. Now, while this airplane crosses the screen in the background, they have a witness on the telephone, Winston Mitchell, and he says he's up at the north side of the towers. And the host says to Winston, can you see, are you on the north side the plane made contact. And Winston says, yes, I am, I'd say let me go and get a better look right now. And then we hear the sounds of Winston as though he's shuffling about to go and have a better look. Like we hear someone kind of clomp around a little bit, like he's walking somewhere, going somewhere. And we hear another indistinguishable voice in the background. And the host says to Winston, okay, go ahead. So Winston's supposed to be looking out at what's happening on the tower. And then he says, I'd say the hole takes about... And just when he's at this point, the plane enters the screen here, crosses to the left, and disappears behind the towers. It looks as though 6 or 7 floors were taken out. And there's more explosions right now. Hold on. People are running. Hold on. So Winston's claiming that that moment there's a second airplane crash. Or actually, he's not saying it's an airplane crash at the moment. He's just saying there's more explosions. Now, the host then says, hold on, we have an explosion inside. And Winston says, the building is exploding right now. You got people running up the street, and I'm going to see what's going on. And the host says, okay, put Winston on pause there for a moment. And that's the end of this clip of Winston on the phone. Now, there are a number of anomalies in this. One is that when Winston says he's going to look outside at the burning towers to tell us what's going on, and then we hear him shuffling about, which sounds like a clop, like someone's clopping their feet to pretend they're shuffling, they're going somewhere. But then when he is reporting all these explosions, we don't hear the explosions on Winston's telephone. Whereas if he was really holding the telephone and he's hearing explosions, would we not hear explosions over his telephone line? But indeed, in this case, we don't. And we find this in 3 of the live coverages of these witnesses who are claiming that they're hearing explosions, but really there's no indication of any evidence of that on their telephone calls. We don't hear their explosions. Okay, this is just a minor point here. One of the most unusual features in the CNN coverage is that their screen completely blacks out for a second at the moment of the supposed airplane impact. And actually, there are 8 black frames. So a blackout is produced by like a technician who has a fade out button. And that's what they did. They blacked out you saw this airplane kind of going behind the North Tower, and then you see this blackout, and then it comes back and there's an explosion. You see the explosion. But they had this blackout before the moment of impact. Okay, what happened in this most important shot in the century was this sudden blackout at that instant? And we actually find this type of blackout on two of the five major network coverages. At the moment of impact, there are blackouts on the screen. Okay, now, the airplane in this video is quite dark, almost black. And these planes were not black. They're not dark. They seem to be a metallic gray. And it was a sunny, sunny day in New York City. So, but the scene, the airplane on the CNN coverage is this kind of like black, poorly shaped plane that kind of moves across the screen from the right to the left and disappears behind the North Tower. But the image is quite blurred and unnatural looking. And it's a bright day and it's a light gray plane. So why are these like simply black airplanes on the screen? And what's interesting also is, see, what one sees when one looks at the different media coverage of the airplane on that day and then of subsequent amateur videos which emerged, one finds is that in all the different videos, the plane has different attributes. Like in some of the videos of the plane approaches the tower on a flat horizontal angle for seconds before the tower. Whereas on other videos, it's what they call the dive bomber scenario. And the airplane kind of falls out of the sky from behind and above the towers. That's on two of the major networks have the dive bomber scenario, and other amateur video have the horizontal flight path. Okay. Some of the videos have the airplane looking quite white, like the picture shot from below the street of the plane entering the second tower. The plane is almost white, whereas in other videos, the Al-Qaeda video of the airplane on the horizontal course, the plane is completely black. Now, people have to understand that airplanes are not like quantum particles. Like a quantum particle, you might say, is kind of, it can be here, there, and everywhere at the same time. It explores all possibilities of being. Okay, but airplanes aren't like that. You can't have a charcoal airplane that's also white. You can't have an airplane that has a horizontal course that then also drops out of the sky like a dive bomber. You see, they've made up all these different images of this fabled airplane, but they're not consistent with each other. They disqualify one another. And you look at the images, and the images on the different networks, it's completely different blobs or entities. On one, it's like this dark black plane moving in a horizontal path. Another, the dive bomber scenario, in one of the pictures of it, it looks like a rounded blob that falls from above. They call it the ball, I think he calls it. And it's hardly distinguishable as a plane. Okay, and another of their shots, it's like a streak from above. Now, the problem is, see, airplanes aren't like quantum particles. You can't have a white plane that's also charcoal that drops down from above that also flies on the horizontal course. See, a plane can't explore all possibilities simultaneously like a quantum particle can. Okay? In a way, most of the videos of the fabled airplane disqualify each other. They're inconsistent with each other. And when one begins to look, you look at the graphics on these images, they're terrible. In some of the images of the plane hitting the tower, you see the pixel bleed. That in front of the airplane, in front of its nose, just before it's impacting the tower, you see the pixel bleed of that layered image bleeding over into the image of the tower. So it causes pixel bleed that you can see on the screen. which is absurd. Airplanes can't cause pixel bleed. The only thing that can cause pixel bleed is when you have layered images in the technician's lab, and then you can have pixel bleed from different layers. One of the most shocking shots from these five live coverage is what's called the nose-out shot. And this is taken from a Fox helicopter, which is initially several miles from the towers. And 6 seconds before the impact of the second airplane, you have this Fox helicopter shot, which shows the towers in the distance, and you can see for miles out to the right, to the west of the towers, from the helicopter. And then the helicopter image, then the helicopter camera, focuses up closer on the towers, then closer and closer. So it's way back, several miles back. Within 6 seconds, it shifts its focus up until it's just framing the tower. And then all of a sudden, the airplane's there. Okay? Once it's focused up the last time, it's zoomed in three times. The last time it zooms in, all of a sudden, the airplane's there. And the airplane in this shot is in the screen for 1 to 2 seconds. Okay, now, what's so unusual about this is that 6 seconds ago, before the moment of impact, you had a panoramic view of New York City for miles out to the west, and there's no airplanes in sight. And then they zoom up three times, and then all of a sudden you got an airplane there. And the film editor shows you how if you back out, there's no airplane. And they calculate that the airplane would have been having to travel at 550 miles an hour to have hit the tower in that period of time from when the helicopter first zoomed up on this image. So that's one anomaly in this film. Now the next one is that when this airplane hits the tower, on the Fox News helicopter picture, you see the image enter the tower on one side, and then you see its nose stick out on the other, as though this airplane has traveled all the way through the tower unimpeded and stuck its nose out the other side of the building. This is what was shown on TV. It's called the nose-out shot. Okay, now, the film editor then does a pixel analysis. He looks at the pixel, he examines the pixel of the nose entering the plane and the nose exiting the plane, and he shows that it's indeed exactly the same. So not only now does the TV film actually suggest that this plane went right through the building with no obvious obstruction of its motion in any way. It just went right through, like there's no slowdown in its momentum. It sticks its nose out the other side, and his nose is completely undamaged, passing through this steel frame building with massive central columns. Now, of course, this is absurd that a plane could do that. But then, of course, there's no shots of any airplane nose sticking outside of the other tower after the collision had occurred. You see, it wasn't that people afterwards said, oh, look, there's the nose of the plane sticking out. No, there was no nose of the plane sticking out any of the holes in the building. But that was what was shown on TV from the Fox helicopter, this nose-out shot. And the film editor shows likely how this was caused, because really all that they did was they had this airplane image as an overlay moving towards the tower, but they moved it too far so that it projected the nose outside the other side of the building. You see, that, and he estimated the time mistake was 0.28 seconds. If they'd stopped the movement of the plane on its horizontal flight path a quarter of a second earlier, you wouldn't have seen this nose out. But this nose out shot has to be a fakery. Okay, you simply cannot have an aluminum plane passing right through a steel frame building unimpeded, sticking its nose out undamaged on the other side of the building. This is absolutely absurd. You see, it wasn't a real plane at all. All it was an image of an airplane. And they moved it too far along the horizontal axis. This is clearly evident on the September Clue series. And then what's so funny about this clip is that within 6 minutes or 8 minutes, this clip was being showed on CNN. And when they showed it on CNN, they obscured the airplane hitting the building, both coming into the building and its nose out. They obscured that whole scene by using their banner. So here on CNN, they're saying, here's a dramatic evidence of an airplane hitting the South Tower today. But in the background, the whole time they're saying, there, you see the evidence of the airplane. And the host is saying that, but in the background, you're not seeing anything because they covered up the whole thing using their banner. Because they realize, this nose-out shot is a little bit of a public embarrassment because that's not realistic. Planes don't pass through buildings unimpeded without being damaged. So they had to obscure this nose-out shot. Now, it's not just all the images of the airplane that are fake, but the more I listen to the conversations ongoing in the media labs while this airplane enters and exits the scene in the background, and the conversations, the witnesses, they're obviously pre-scripted because they make so many, like, ridiculous kinds of mistakes. And here I'd like to give another example. This is CBS. And the host, he has Teresa Renault is with us right now. Miss Renault, good morning. Good morning. How are you? This is Brian Gummel. I'm down at 59th and 5th. Where are you? I am in Chelsea, she says. And we are at 8th and 16th. We are the tallest building in the area. And my window faces south. So it looks directly onto the World Trade Center. And I would say, you know, approximately 10 minutes ago, there was a major explosion from probably, it looks like about the 80th floor. It looks like it has affected probably 4 to 8 floors. Major flames are coming out of the north side and also the east side of the building. Yes. The host says, yeah, you're over in Chelsea. Did you hear the explosion from your position? And Mrs. Renault says, oh, yes, we did. As a matter of fact, we heard it, and because I was just like standing there, pretty much looking out the window. I didn't see what caused it or if there was an impact. And then the host says, so you have no idea right now. Okay, and just as the host is saying that, we see the airplane appear on the back screen, crossing the screen, and it's on their screen for 2 seconds. And then Mr. Noah says, oh, there's another one. Another plane just hit. Oh, my God, another plane has just hit. Another building flew right into the middle of it. Explosion. That's what she says. Now, if there's anybody who's not brain damaged out there, if you listen to this script, one moment she is saying, I didn't see what caused it or if there was an impact. And then a moment later she's saying, oh, there's another one. Another plane just hit. Oh, my God, another plane has just hit another building. Flew right into the middle of it. Now, excuse me, but she just told us she didn't know what hit the first building. And then secondly, a moment later, she's saying, oh, there's another plane, belying what she thought, belying what she knew ahead of time. Because she knew what the story was supposed to be, that there were supposed to be 2 planes, but she slipped up. You see, what happened is ridiculous. She said, I didn't see what caused it. And then in the next breath, she says, oh, there's another one, another plane. See, it's a farce. She got mixed up because they're scripted. So they're not really reporting things they've seen, and there's all these little inconsistencies in all this testimony that makes it appear farcical the more you go into it. Consider this a little bit, another enigma in her testimony or her eyewitness. And this is how she uses the word I and we in her conversation. Okay, now consider this. She says, I am in Chelsea and we are at 8th and 16th. We are the tallest building in the area and we, my window faces south. Okay, now this is odd. Like, now obviously here she's saying, well, we are at 8th and 16th. She's referring to herself and her husband, Jack Renaud, who's a producer at the NBC. Okay, so she's likely referring to him. Like, you know how she says, like, I am in Chelsea and we are at 8th and 16th. Yeah, like we, meaning her and her husband are at 8th and 16th. We are the tallest building in the area. And we, she says, but then she switches and it's my window faces south. Now why all of a sudden it was we and then all of a sudden it's her window? Okay. Okay, well, which is odd. And then she, when she hears the, asked if she heard the explosion, Miss Renaud responds, yes, yes, we did. She says, we. And then she continues on, as a matter of fact, and this is what she says. She says, we heard it, and 'cause I was just standing there pretty much looking out the window. Now, in this sense, she starts out saying, we heard it, and she says we twice, and then she kind of corrects herself where she says, and she repeats that, 'cause I was just standing there pretty much looking out the window. Now, I don't know how many people out there in TV land, I don't know how many people out there pretty much look out a window. Now, I'm not used to talking about this. I've never in my life said to anyone, well, I was pretty much looking out a window. You know, like, it's absurd the way she's speaking. See, she wasn't really doing these things at all, and she's trying to describe it, but what she describes is so artificial. And the way she says, we heard it, I would think Miss Renaud had her husband Jack there up with her, trying to give her support through her scripted actress. See, this is a complete faked witness. See, early they're trying to establish early on that there was a fake plane that went into the first building and then another plane here, and they're planting these seeds to plant the story, to create the mythology of what happened. But anyway, so Miss Renaud, she says, we heard it. Okay, now, I wonder, does she have a multiple personality disorder, or is there someone there to support her and guide her through her acting bit, but who is not supposed to be mentioned? The way she starts to say, as a matter of fact, we heard it, and 'cause I was just like there standing pretty much looking out the window. Like, she started to say we, but I think Jack was saying, no, not we, you. So she was in mid-sentence there. It kind of held her up, and then she says, 'cause I was just like standing there. How do people talk like this? Like, I was just like standing there, pretty much looking out the window. It's so artificial. Okay, and then that was just other aspects of her script. And then at the end, there were other questions. It's like every time I listened and watched these videos, it's all these things that absolutely don't make sense. Like, for instance, why does she say that she saw major flames coming out of the building? But she's saying, describing what she's seeing, at the same time it's being shown on TV, and on TV there's not major flames coming out of the building. There's billowing black smoke from oxygen-starved fires. So there's not major flames coming out of the building, even while she's saying this, and she's reportedly looking at the building from her window, describing what she's seeing, major flames. But there's not major flames. It's billowing smoke, you see. But whoever scripted her had it wrong. He thought, oh, it's a fire. You're going to see flames. But there wasn't. There was billowing smoke. And then she ends her little acting bit. At one point, she adds, at the very end of one of her sentences, she adds at the end, explosion. And if you listen to her say, explosion, the way she says it, it is like totally artificial. But it's right after she says, oh, there's another one. Another plane just hit. Oh, my God, another plane has just hit another building. Flew right into the middle of it. Explosion. And that's kind of how she said it. It's just like it's stuck on at the end. And the way she says it, if you listen to it a couple times, it's absurd. You see, what happened really is that she looked down at her piece of paper and she realized that she hadn't said explosion, so she tacked it on at the end. Explosion! But it was totally artificially done. Now, I went through each of these videos of the five major news networks' coverage. And they're just, every one of them is riddled with all these absurdities and inconsistencies. And I arrived at a point, I just realized this whole thing is a fraud. This whole thing's been created within the media studios. Okay? And they have actresses and actors there. You even find some of the actresses. There's on the media clips, there's one woman who goes, oh my God! And then later you find that same, oh my God, is on one of the amateur videos that was turned in. The same sound clip. Okay? Yeah, and in fact, that sound clip is also on another one of the networks. You see, they were sharing sound clips. See, the whole thing was concocted. There were no airplanes, okay? What there was an elaborate media hoax using visual technicians and their labs and sound studios and scripted actors and actresses. And the more I started watching this series, I worked for 30 years as a psychologist, and I learned how to kind of listen to people and kind of detect deception and all the non sequiturs people have in their speech that indicate there's something there or something peculiar or something not quite right. Like, in ways, if someone's telling the truth about something, then there's certain authenticating factors when they speak the truth, and they don't have to kind of think of what they say, and they don't say inconsistent things. Okay, but if someone's concocting a lie, well, then these things come up because they haven't really seen what they're supposed to have seen, and they're not really reporting on their own experience. Now, there's this one. Let me see here. This is another instance. Like, here is one news anchor on that day, Jamie McKintry, who's on scene at the Pentagon. Now, here's an instance of a reporter. He just describes what he's seen. And he says on CNN, I transcribed this, you know, it must have appeared that way, but from my close-up inspection, there is no evidence of a plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon. The only site is the actual side of the building that has crashed in. And as I said, the only pieces left that you can see are small enough you can pick them up in your hand. There are no large tail sections, wing sections, or fuselage, nothing like that anywhere around that would indicate that the entire plane crashed into the side of the Pentagon. Now, in that script of his, he talks perfectly sensibly. Like, he doesn't say, well, I was pretty much looking at the Pentagon. He's not pretty much looking at the Pentagon, okay? No, he's there. He's looking at it. So he doesn't have to say, well, I was pretty much looking at the Pentagon. Like Miss Renault, who says, I was pretty much looking out the window. You see, and when Jamie does this reporting, like the script, like he talks complete sentences and not all broken up sentences because he's describing something that's real. Okay? Whereas what you find in their scripted actresses and actors, there's all these absurd little elements in their text, which to me indicate completely that they're lying and confabulating. They weren't really witnesses. See, within the 5 minutes of the first airplane striking, all the major networks had someone on air live claiming to have witnessed the airplane going into the first tower. You see, they want to get the story. They want to, you know, because people will be tuned into their media. So they want to set it real early. Oh, there was an airplane. Okay, and even when they have the witnesses, some of the witnesses, they say, oh, it's a commercial jet. Another said, oh, a cruise missile with wings. Another person said a small passenger plane with propellers. And it was all conflicting, even in their descriptions of what this entity was, which is interesting because I think what they like to do is kind of create uncertainty for a while, and then they kind of finalize what it was, and then they edit out the other versions. But just so I've been going through this series trying to analyze each of these clips, and all of the clips, there's not one clip of the fabled airplane hitting the South Tower that, in my view, has any credibility. Each of them has multiple mistakes and inconsistencies within it. Okay, let me try to give another example of some of these. It's a long article, okay, I can't spend too long on trying to find this out. I'll do a more thorough kind of presentation on this at one point. I've been writing this article up the last 2 weeks, actually, because I was a guest on Rick Adams' show on RBN one evening, and we were talking about this no plane issue. And when I was saying when I did my PhD studies, what I did was I developed a way of transcribing psychotherapy transcripts. So, and when I did my research, I had to write down everything that people said. And when you actually try to do it, it's so complicated because people say so many things like, or partial sentences and things like that, that if you just listen to it ordinarily, you forget about it immediately and you kind of just get the content of what they say. But if you go back and look at their specific wording, it shows a lot of anomalies and inconsistencies and unusual things in there. So it's very interesting to break these people's speech down. Like what I was trying to show about what Miss Renault says, where she's claiming that she viewed the airplane from up in Chelsea. Oh no, she didn't know what caused the crash until she saw the second airplane. Then she said, oh, there's another airplane. But why is she doing all this weird stuff about the I and the we? You know, I am in Chelsea, we are the tallest building, my window. We heard the explosions, and then I was pretty much standing there looking out the window. See, it's like, why is all this stuff with this I and the me? And what just makes sense of it all is that she had Jack there with her and trying to say, don't refer to me, don't refer to me. And so she's continuing to have to switch from we to I, and she's not used to that because he's there and he's with her. So that's why she keeps saying, we heard the explosion. Now, if you're in your apartment alone, do you think you would say to someone, "We heard the explosion"? Like, unless you're multiple personality disorder, I don't think you would. You'd say, "I heard the explosion," but she doesn't do that. Who was with Miss Renault that day? You see, what you get when you really look at the media coverage of that day, the author concludes, the author of the video series, he says, 9/11 TV was one big lie. It was scripted. You see, these people don't just report what happens. They actually help to stage it. I don't believe there was a second airplane. There's never been an airplane in the history of humanity that just crashed into a building and just disappeared inside, leaving no evidence of it outside. And these weren't just any buildings. These were massive concrete and steel-framed buildings. And you think these little airplanes just hopped inside and disappeared so tidy and completely? It's absurd to think that. Just like it's absurd to think a 120-story building can blow up and fall down into its own footprints in 15 seconds due to an airplane crash. It's absurd. It's like we have a nation of people who have grown up on Roadrunner cartoons and Homer Simpson. So it's like you can do almost anything and they'll believe anything. You see, it's absurd. The idea that those airplane crashes caused the towers to fall down in that way. It's absurd to think that. It's absurd to think like Mike Harris, another reporter, who describes, he says that people, he's been getting lots of emails and phone calls because people say that what I said, it couldn't be true, that I couldn't have seen an airplane crash into the Pentagon. And then he's trying to explain, and he tries to explain how he says, you can't imagine that an airplane like this would just disappear inside the building. And then he's explaining how when the airplane hit the building, its wings folded back like this. And he shows it like you're folding back something. And he says the wings folded back and the airplane fit into that small hole. That's why the hole isn't as big as one might expect, he says. See, this is another one of those things which is absolutely absurd. How could an airplane fold back its wings in an instant of time to fit into a 14 or 16-foot hole? It just doesn't happen. In Hollywood, it can happen, or your corporate media could show it as happening because they got their video studios. But in real life, it doesn't happen. And it's not just the wings on this airplane, it's 6-ton engines. Did these engines fold back at the moment of impact? Of course not. It's absurd. The more and more you go into the media coverage of the day, it leads me to the conclusion that there was a criminal conspiracy that day. The corporate media coordinated their efforts. There are other interesting features like the 17-second time delay on all the 5 broadcasts, and how you have these sound indicators that occurred like so many seconds before impact on different soundtracks. There's so many inconsistencies. The only way to explain it is that they co-conspired together that day to create, first they wanted you to believe an airplane had hit the first tower instead of simply a hole being blown up in the tower, and then they wanted you to believe it was an airplane going into the second tower. Okay, I believe there were no airplanes in the first tower or the second. All there were explosions, and then they used their video studios to superimpose images of planes. But they created so many different videos that they're all self-contradictory. You can't have a charcoal white plane that descends from above and comes on a horizontal flight path at the same time. Like, it's just inconsistent. And you listen to all the witnesses, and the more you listen to them, they all sound like they're making up what they say. even in their language and speech and automaticities, don't make sense. So my paper is called Fabled Airplanes, The Role of the Corporate Media in Creating and Perpetuating the Mass Hypnosis of the American Public. The people of America have to realize that your corporate media is owned by the same criminal psychopathic networks that doing 9/11, who are doing the banker bailouts, who are spraying you with chemtrails, who are going to start using your military against you and destroying the life and the mammal life on the East and West Coast and the Gulf of Mexico. They're going to have poisoned inoculations for you. These people are eugenicists. They want to believe, they believe in the one world order under their fascist control. And unfortunately, these things are true. People say to me sometimes, oh, you must be a conspiracy theorist. Of course I'm a conspiracy theorist. I'm not an idiot. How could you not be a conspiracy theorist? You would have to know nothing about human history. You'd have to know nothing about what's happening now in modern times. And we know all these groups are secret societies. The Bilderbergs and the Skull and Bones and Bohemian Grove and Council on Foreign Relations, and all these are secret societies. Okay, they are. That's they're known to be. They have a public face, but they're secret societies where these people get together and they scheme things. Conspire means to breathe together. So these people get together and they breathe together and they plan different things they're going to perpetrate against the American public and different things they're going to do to the nation. These people schemed 60 years ago that they were going to destroy the American middle class and destroy the manufacturing sector of the American economy, because America was growing so free and wealthy that they were afraid it would be their obstacle to a new world order. So now these psychopaths have taken over the American government and the American military, and that's not just in the United States. I live in Canada. It's the same here. You know, we're run by these networks of criminals up here as well. And this is a problem human race is facing on this planet. Somehow our nations have been stolen from us, and the public has been so deceived about all the events going on in the world. And it's all done through the TV, which makes it all so reasonable and sensible. When you turn on your TV, you realize these people, you got to look at the September Clue series. You know, when I study that as a forensic psychologist, to me after a while, it just became so obvious the whole thing was a fraud. And I have a 20-page article done on this. I hope to have it up on my website this week. But I'm only halfway through the series analyzing it. There's so much in it, and it's so funny. When you listen to it, it's so funny. Because, see, what happens on the day something like this happens? Everybody's so traumatized, and you know, you forget exactly what you saw, and things that don't make sense. Well, things don't seem not to make sense at the time. It's only afterwards, when you really think about it, that you begin to question. Like when 9/11 happened, I was working in the prison in Ontario, and I watched the second airplane. I was on my dorm with 24 criminal guys, kind of. We watched it together there. And when it all happened, you know, and even in the days after, I could never have imagined that anyone, like, this could be an inside job. You know, like, sure, you know, Muslim terrorists, in a way, it just all made sense, and I never really thought about it. It wasn't for me till 5 years later that when I saw Loose Change and I saw the documentaries of the squibs going off in the building and how the buildings came down. It's like so obviously controlled demolition. But previously, I'd never really thought about it. I'd never really looked back and considered it and considered the evidences. And the more one does that, the more the evidence is, the evidence for a fabled plane, they're not there. I don't consider there's any evidence for any fabled airplanes. You see, because not only is the airplane all different in all these different videos, but if there was a real airplane, there wouldn't have been a need for creating all these fake videos. And each different fake video has different fake features in it. It's a fascinating study. Watch the series September Clues. I hope to post my article up this week. I notice we're just coming down to 6 o'clock. So that's what I've been doing lately. I'm kind of doing this investigative piece on the fabled airplanes and a lot more evidence why there were no airplanes that day. The whole thing was a media hoax by CNN, the most trusted name in news. Yeah, give me a break. Okay. Anyway, we're very fortunate to have networks like BBS. Thanks, Don, Doug, Seth. I'll be back Christmas Day. I think I'm intending to do a live show. Please visit my website, zeropoint.ca, and have a look at my books and try to remember yourself. Every now and then, take some deep breaths and try to wake up to the present moment and fully, more fully experience the present. Thank you all. Goodbye.